Wednesday, April 6, 2016. You are listening to the Daily Dose Sports Podcast, and I am your host, Clint Daly, sports writer from Denver, Colorado. Hey, you know, we release new podcasts every single Wednesday, and we bring you our own outlook on the world of sports. You can go download the podcast on iTunes. You can subscribe to it. You can go over to places like Stitcher or Podcast Republic, and you can subscribe to it there. Or you can always head over to our website, dailydosesports.wordpress.com. You can listen to it there. We also put up an article or two every single week that you are sure to enjoy. We did put one up this week that you might want to go over and check out. It's kind of an interesting thing. It's more of a scientific article. You might want to check that one out. If you would like to contact the show for any reason, you got a question, you got a comment, maybe you don't agree with a certain take that we might have here on the show, feel free to send it over to us. We would love to hear from you. You can email us, dailydosesports@gmail.com. That is D-A-L-Y, dailydosesports@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook. Both of those handles are at Daily Dose Sports. This week on the show, we've got a number of things that we've got to get to. Going to break down the Final Four and the championship game. What an amazing finish we had to March Madness. We're going to take a look at some, you know, the NBA standings, a couple possible playoff scenarios that we might be looking at, a few different things going on in the NBA that are a little bit interesting that we want to kind of keep an eye on. You know, we might have to get to a few NFL stories. There's a couple stories out there that I want to touch on. Major League Baseball opened their 2016 season this week, so we might have to touch on that. Plus, as we do every single week, we have got to get to our Daily Dose Top 5, always a popular segment. You want to make sure that you stick around for that. Of course, you know, a few things coming out in the world of sports. For one, the Golden State Warriors go down again last night, losing 124-117 to the Minnesota Timberwolves. Really? Timberwolves got you? It's kind of starting to tell me that maybe you guys are running out of gas just a little bit. I know that the Warriors are kind of, you know, trying to make this push and seeing if they can't, you know, find a way to break the Chicago Bulls record from 1996. Yeah, it's kind of starting to look like maybe that isn't going to happen because they are clearly running out of gas at this point. You know, and the struggle for them is you get through this whole thing. You roll through this whole season and you play, you know, as hard as they've played to try to get to the point where they're at. And you do kind of have to sit there and have in the back of your mind, oh, yeah, we do still have, you know, the playoffs coming. We do still have teams that are going to be trying to take our heads off coming. They have four games left. They are sitting at 69 games, so they have to win all four games to break the record. They've got to win three of those to tie the Chicago Bulls record. And, you know, it's now that's even starting to come out, Draymond Green comes out today and he says, well, to be honest, we're kind of just tired of the regular season. It's 82 games. It's a long season. And we're kind of just, you know, we're kind of just tired of the regular season. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what happens. That's kind of what the Chicago Bulls went through. They just also found a way to still win those games. Yes, of course you're getting tired now because now your bodies are starting to wear out. That's what makes what Chicago did in 96 so incredible. I don't know if you saw this. A group of New England Patriots fans is suing the NFL in an effort to recover the first-round draft pick that was taken from the team as punishment for that whole Deflategate scandal. Remember, the NFL gave them that million-dollar fine, took the draft pick away. And if you'll remember, their owner, Robert Kraft, agreed to it. Now, there's been a suit filed on Tuesday in federal court in Boston saying that the NFL made an arbitrary and capricious decision to revoke the draft picks, even though there is no proof that the team deliberately deflated those footballs. Well, here's the problem. Your owner accepted it. So you can sue whoever you want. You can say whatever you want. Your owner accepted it. So, yeah, too bad. Kind of too bad for you. Looks like the Patriots are, you're not going to get that pick back. The pick is gone, and you know, the draft is in less than a month. I got news for you. There isn't a lawsuit in the world that works that fast. So, yeah, you're not getting that pick back. Enjoy giving that one up. Los Angeles Lakers coach Byron Scott has expressed some frustration with the way that his team is playing because, you know, it's the final year for Kobe Bryant. And he is getting ready to finish out his last few games playing in the NBA. Byron Scott says it really bothers me that his last 5, 6, 7, 8 games are going to be with the way that we're playing as a team. You know, that he said this after the Clippers, you know, stomped on the Lakers 103-81 on Tuesday night. He says it bothers him because you're talking about a champion. And because he is a champion, he hates to see Kobe Bryant going out this way. Unfortunately, that's just the way it has to be. Yeah, it is, Byron. There's a couple reasons that it has to be this way. And the biggest reason that it has to be this way is because Kobe Bryant made it this way when he took that giant contract and didn't leave any money to sign anybody else. So while I understand that Kobe's one of the greats, and I get that Kobe is one of, you know, the greatest players to ever play, you kind of made this bed. I mean, when you took that huge, giant contract, you kind of tied the hands of the Lakers franchise in being able to do anything else. So yes, you're going to go limping out of your career, but that's kind of the choice you made. I'm sorry, I don't feel bad for you. That's the choice that you made. That's the bed that you made. Now you kind of get to sleep in it. So yeah, I don't really feel bad for him. You know, of course, the big news was the incredible NCAA championship game between Villanova and North Carolina that took place on Monday night. What a great game. And I'm going to be honest, it's a good thing it was a great game, because the last few rounds of March Madness have been pretty awful. Sweet 16, not very good. Elite 8, again, not very good. Okay, Final Four, we're going to have some really good games in the Final Four. Yeah, not at all. All kind of just snooze fest blowouts. But then on Monday night, College Hoops went out and totally redeemed themselves. I mean, it kind of reminds you of how good and how fun college basketball can be, because, like I said, the Final Four was bad on Saturday, and I'm tuned into the Final Four. I'm excited to watch the Final Four and see exactly what we're gonna have in the Final Four. Villanova faces Oklahoma first game from Houston, and I'm looking at this saying, you know, Oklahoma can score. They're gonna go out and do some things. We saw Villanova flex some serious muscle. They smother Oklahoma defensively, and what they did was they came out and they forced Oklahoma guard Buddy Hield, who looked like the best player in the tournament, to put the ball on the floor and said, hey, we're going to pressure you and pressure you and pressure you. We're not going to let you take those shots you've been taking wide open. We're going to pressure every single thing that you do. And if you can prove that you can put the ball on the floor, we're also going to have some help backing our defenders when you do that. And I'm going to be honest, kind of revealed some flaws in Buddy Hield's game, didn't it? He's not that strong off the dribble. At least he's not yet. He can develop that part of his game, but he didn't look very strong off the dribble at all. Like, he really looked kind of bad off the dribble. Kind of interesting to see. Now, you know, they hold Buddy Hield to just 9 points on 4 of 12 shooting. The score was 42-28 at the half. Like, I'm watching the score at the half, and I'm going, oh, okay, you know, this is going to be a kind of a comeback. We'll get back in this. Oklahoma will you know, at least make this kind of competitive. It's a 14-point game, but, hey, we know they can score, you know, points. They can score points quickly, in fact. And then, coming out of halftime, OU just quit. They just, and I don't mean like they sort of quit. Like, they flat out quit. Like, they might as well have just sat down on the floor and not done anything, because they quit. There's no nice way to say it. It just kind of bizarre. I mean, to be fair, it was a little weird. I thought this was like a little weird, a little bit strange. Didn't you think it was like a little bit strange that in a game of this magnitude, like one of the biggest games that Oklahoma basketball has been involved in, and I thought it was a little bit weird that they let, you know, Bob Stoops coach the team. A little bit strange. Big game Bob hasn't won a big game in a while, but yeah, whatever. I mean, that's the decision that they made. I guess you just live with that. I don't know. I thought it was kind of weird. So, I mean, they end up blowing Oklahoma out. Biggest loss deficit in Final Four history. 44 points? Really? 44 points? Just quit. And man, Lon Kruger's a good coach. Kind of weird. Now that's supposed to be the close game. That's supposed to be the more competitive game. Then we get to the game that I told you last week I didn't think would be very good. North Carolina versus Syracuse. And it wasn't good either. Carolina shot 54% against that Syracuse 2-3 zone. And honestly, they made it look pretty easy. I mean, it didn't look like they were really being that challenged. And that shouldn't be overlooked. Understand this. Jim Boeheim is one. He's one of the most boring interviews like ever on the planet. But don't underestimate how good Jim Boeheim is at coaching that 2-3 zone. It's funny because teams will sit there and they'll come out against that 2-3 zone that Syracuse runs every year, all the time. And of course, everybody has a scheme to beat it. They'll say, "Well, hey, let's go short corner and we'll kind of attack it on the low side." He adjusts. He adjusts, and his zone all of a sudden shuts down that short corner. People say, well, let's attack the high post. We'll play some high-low game. We'll dump it into the high post. We'll look down low. We'll look to corner. We'll look to move the ball from there. He adjusts. It's not just that you say, well, they got the 2-3 zone, and we attack the 2-3 zone, and we'll beat it. That's not the case. He always seems to adjust his zone for how the offenses are playing it, but Carolina tore that zone up. Think about this for 1 second. North Carolina scored 50 points in the paint. See, here's the thing you got to think about. When you're playing against a zone, especially a 2-3 zone, but any of those zones, zones are geared to take away points in the paint. And so what a lot of people do, especially young players, especially people that maybe aren't that well versed in zone offense and that kind of thing, what they do is they say, okay, well, they're playing a zone, so that means we shoot a lot of threes. That means we're going to be open from outside. You shoot some threes, and we're going to get them out of that zone. That's exactly what the zone wants you to do. They want you to shoot contested threes. And you'll knock a couple of them down, but overall, you're probably going to fail at consistently knocking them down. But the great teams, the really, really good teams with their zone offense, they don't just take what the defense gives them. The great teams take what they want anyways, no matter what you're trying to give them. Hey, on Saturday, Carolina took exactly what they want. They beat Syracuse by 17, and I'm going to be honest, it didn't really feel that close. Carolina executed so well, dumping it into the high post. They did go high-low. They executed, hitting a high percentage of shots and still generating 50 points in the paint against the defense that sole purpose is to take away your points in the paint. Pretty impressive what Carolina did on Saturday. So we go into Monday night, and honestly, Monday night came around, and I was just like, I'm just hoping we don't have a blowout. But because we've seen, the first round was great, second round was okay, and then it's kind of just gone down from there. Hasn't been very good since then. But we saw pretty early in the game, you could tell Monday night was going to go down to the wire. Monday night was going to go down to the wire because North Carolina is so, so talented. Such an incredibly talented team. And Villanova is just so tough. I don't know that they're that talented, but they're so tough. Couple things I want you to think about. In the first half, North Carolina goes 7-for-9 for three-point range. They led 39-34 at the half. And it's kind of funny because I'm watching the TBS broadcast. I know there's like 5 broadcasts now. You have the TBS one that's kind of the neutral one, and then you have the one on, I don't know, Court TV or something that's the Carolina one, and then you have the one on like, I don't know, the Muppet Network or something, and that's the Villanova one, whatever. There's like 50 broadcasts going. I'm watching the kind of neutral one. And as I'm watching it, and they get to halftime, and like I said, Carolina leads 39-34 at half. I think it was Clark Kellogg, and Clark Kellogg's a smart guy, really, really smart guy. But Clark Kellogg said this. He said, well, the Villanova Wildcats are denying post touches to the Carolina big men, and they were. Villanova was completely going full deny on the Carolina big men because they know how dangerous North Carolina can be if it's getting the ball in the paint. And then Kellogg said, but if they take the paint away, they have to give something back in return. And that's what they're giving back. They're giving back these three-point opportunities in return. He said it like 2 or 3 times. And he couldn't have been more wrong. And like I said, Clark Kellogg's a smart guy. I respect his opinion. He's dead wrong on this. Because there's 2 points I want you to think about. Villanova, defensively, they pressure everything. And what they do in the post, certain teams play the low post different ways. if you're playing the low post, you might, you know, kind of three-quarter over the top, or you might kind of three-quarter from underneath, or you might kind of just, you know, a hand up or whatever it might be. What Villanova does with your post players is they go full front, completely front it, both hands up in the air. They completely deny the post touches. They completely deny it. Full front. Now, you might sit there and say, well, if they full front it, can't I just throw the lob over the top? I mean, isn't that just a layup over the top? You would think so. And it can be, but here's the problem. If you're pressuring the ball out on the perimeter, that's a really tough pass because I've got to throw it over your hand, and then I've got to throw it over the top of the defender, and then I've got to drop it into that little bucket. Also, the help is coming from the backside, so it's not just that he's back there all alone. If they get in those situations, then yes, you're going to give up the layup. But there is help coming from the other side of the floor, and so you're having to drop that into a really, really small window. If you've got good ball pressure, that's a tough play to make. Here's the other thing. The reason that Villanova was giving up those three-pointers was because they committed the cardinal sin of pressure defense. It had nothing to do with them fronting the post down low. That's what they do. You front the post, you help from the backside. That's not the issue. They committed the cardinal sin in pressure defense. What they did, I don't want to get too deep here, but what they did was they helped on penetration and post touches from the ball side of the floor. Let me kind of walk you through this, and again, I don't want to get too complex here, but if the ball comes up the right side of the floor, and say we pass it down to the corner, or it's out on the wing, I can't help if my teammate gets beat or whatever, I can't help from guys on the right side of the floor. If I do, then you drive and you make a quick pass, and that's a three-pointer. I have to help from the guys on the left side of the floor. They've got to slide all the way over and take that help. If I drive from the wing and the guy that's defending the corner slides over to help against me, I just pass it to his man and he scores. It's really, really easy. The help can't come from the same side of the floor. It's got to come from the opposite side of the floor. So if I drive from the wing, the guy on the other side wing, he's got to slide over and stop me. If you help from the same side of the floor, you give up easy threes. That's like the easiest basketball. Drive and kick, drive and kick, drive and kick. Yeah, we're going to knock down threes all night. You're going to be in trouble. So this had nothing to do with the way Villanova was playing the post. This had everything to do with they were committing the cardinal sin. Don't help from the ball side. If you help from the ball side, those rotation errors are going to give up threes, not the post defense. Here's the other thing I want you to think about. Hitting those threes, giving up those threes by Villanova, not the end of the world. Not the end of the world, because here's the thing I want you to think about. We'll make some adjustments. And when they went into halftime, I heard Jay Wright say, well, we've got to stop helping from the ball side of the floor. We're going to get ourselves in trouble doing that. But now you kind of have Carolina thinking, hey, we can hit those shots. We can get those shots whenever we want. And you hit those shots early. You hit those shots early. Like I said, knock down, what, 7-9? They're shooting great. Shooting the best they've ever shot for a Carolina team. Let's be honest, that's not exactly their strength. It's good for them to get them up because they crash the board so well. They go get other shots, but not the best way for them to really beat you. But now you have it in your head that you can kind of hit those threes. Here's the question. Can you do it when the game is tight? You've done it in the first game when it's open and who cares? And hey, we got a long way to go. But what about when the game's tight? What about when it starts getting close? What about when you have to knock down those threes or you're going to be in big trouble? Here's the thing I want you to think about. In the second half, North Carolina went just 3 of 6 from the three-point line, at least before that double-clutch crazy shot from Marcus Page. So they end up going 4 for 7. Quite a bit different. For one, you could tell Villanova adjusted and said, okay, we're not giving up those looks anymore. We're not going to give you those looks. And then they didn't hit quite as high a percentage as they had before. The thing about Villanova and the thing about Jay Wright that I noticed the most, obviously some toughness, they scout their opponents. And I can tell you from experience, you scout certain opponents and you scout certain teams. And I'm telling you, this is what Jay Wright does. And I've never been in their scouting. I don't think I've never seen Jay Wright at a clinic. I can tell you what Jay Wright does with his scouting. They go scout their opponent and then they sit down in a room with his coaches and he says, okay, what does this team like to do? How do they have success? And how do we take it away from them? Because that's what Villanova did every single round of this tournament. Think about this. They faced Iowa. Iowa likes to run around. They like to get a bunch of shots up. They like to get some shots up from deep. Villanova completely took that away, pressured everything. You're not going to get those open shots. Miami, when they face Miami, Miami likes to actually run some, you know, some ball screens and stuff, and they like to post up their guards inside and see if they can't let their guards go to work using some post moves inside. Completely took that away because they full fronted those guards. They completely took that away. I mean, you look at a team like, you know, Kansas. Kansas likes to go outside, and then they dump it down inside, you know, to Perry or someone, and we're going to get some good looks there. Nope, took that away. Oklahoma. I told you Oklahoma will shoot from anywhere. They'll shoot it, and once you start coming out at that, then they'll drive past you and get easy bucks. Nope. They completely pressured those shots and forced you to put it on the floor, and when you put it on the floor, they had help. Whatever you like to do, Villanova takes it away and says, nope, not tonight. You're going to have to beat us a different way. And you might beat us a different way, but you're not going to beat us with that same scenario that you've been using to beat everyone else. Villanova played an old school style of basketball. Tough, physical defense. But there was some old school to it. How many times did you see these guys, especially the guards and stuff, drive in, go to the jump stop, the reverse pivot, and then the shot? That's like an old school, like old man, use that at the ref, you know, at the rec center kind of move. You drive in, you kind of drop step, and then you reverse pivot, and you might even put your hand out. You put your hand out like you're going to shoot it, and then you flip it up. That's an old school play. That's kind of how they play. Here's the thing to think about with Villanova. They don't have a first round pick on that entire roster, but they won with toughness and execution. And yes, you get, you know, the two amazing shots down the stretch, down at the very end of the game. And I didn't particularly care for the Carolina defense on the final play, but I understand it. I understand what they were trying to do. They didn't want to give up the rim. They didn't want to give up something inside. And I'm not going to sit here and nitpick at what Roy Williams did. I thought he coached a phenomenal game. He's got a very, very talented team. The only thing that I didn't like was, you had your big men inside guarding space, not guarding men. Villanova comes down on that very last shot, runs the little handoff rub to Chris Jenkins, and hey, Jenkins hits about 50% of his threes, and you left that guy who, you know, half of his threes go in, you left him basically unguarded because you had your big men guarding the rim, but he wasn't guarding a man. So I guess we can nitpick and say maybe that wasn't the best defensive plan, but... I mean, to their credit, UNC had played very well. Maybe UNC thought, hey, when we hit that shot, it's just our night. When we hit that shot, all we got to do is you know, just some token pressure, and they'll miss a long shot. Kind of let them get the ball up a little too quick, and then you leave probably the most dangerous shooter on the floor because he's the inbounder, and because he is such a deadly shooter, you leave Chris Jenkins out there on the dribble handoff to just wide open look. Yeah, I guess if they had it to do over, maybe they would change that a little bit. But it was a fun game. It was an interesting game. I've already heard some people saying it's one of the greatest games ever in a championship game. I'm okay with that. I've heard some other people say it's not even in contention. It was a great finish, but it wasn't a great game. Well, it was a pretty good game. Both teams played very, very well. Both teams shot a very high percentage, and it wasn't because of poor defense. The defense was good. They just knocked down shots again and again and again. I thought it was a very, very well-played game. I would put it up there in probably the top five of championship games I've ever seen. Excellent played game. Enjoyed Monday night. A lot of fun for college basketball. Speaking of the NBA, we got to switch over to the NBA. You know, there's only like four or five games left in the season. But there are a few teams that you're going to want to keep an eye on. A few situations with the playoffs coming that you're going to kind of want to watch. Here's a few things I want you to think about. Over in the East, right now, the Pacers are sitting at the 7th seed. The Pistons are at the 8, but they're at just a half game difference. Now, you might sit there and say, well, it's the 7 and the 8 seed. Who cares? Well, if the season were to end right now, the Pacers would face the Raptors. The Pistons would face the Cavaliers. Here's something I want you to think about, because remember, that could switch real easy. It's just a half game. If the Pacers drop down to 8, if the Pistons jump up to 7, whatever that might be, here's something I want you to think about. Because you might sit there and say, well, who cares? It's the Eastern Conference, big deal. It's the very back end of the Eastern Conference, big deal. No one cares. Here's something I want you to think about. The Cleveland Cavaliers this year against Indiana are 3-0. They're 3-0 against Indiana. Indiana's 41-36. They've had some flashes. They've looked good at times. But for whatever reason, Cleveland has managed to beat them 3 times. They still have to play them one more time. Against the Detroit Pistons, the Pistons sit at the last spot. They are 41-37. Again, yeah, they're kind of scrappy. We know under Van Gundy they're gonna you know be kind of scrappy. The Cleveland Cavaliers against the Pistons this year, and they have to play them one more time. They're 1-2 against the Pistons this year. You think the Cavaliers aren't paying attention to who's in the 7th or 8th spot? I got news for you. They're probably watching that pretty intently. Because you have one team who you've managed to beat every single time you face them. You've got another team that hasn't just beaten you once. They've beaten you twice. And they could beat you a third time. You always got to kind of look at some of these matchups. Cleveland might be rooting a little bit for the Pistons to get out of that 8th spot. They might be hoping the Pacers lose their next few games because they just might not want to face the Pistons. Chicago Bulls are just 2 games out of a playoff spot. I don't think they're going to get in, but that's something else to keep an eye on. One other thing to look at over on the Eastern side, you know, the Boston Celtics, who knocked off the Warriors on Saturday, they are currently sitting at the 4 seed. They are actually tied with the Miami Heat, but they are sitting at the 4 seed based on head-to-head. Miami's sitting at the 5 spot. The thing with that, and Charlotte is just like a half game behind that. Whoever gets that 4 seed gets a home playoff series. Whoever gets the 5 and the 6 has to go on the road for whoever they play. So Boston, Miami, and Charlotte right there in the thick of it as well. Another thing to kind of keep an eye on in the NBA, you know, just a few games. Like I said, 4 or 5 games left. You might want to watch that. On the West side, the top seeds are pretty well set. Like I said, Golden State's sitting there with 69 wins. They've got to win 4 to break the Chicago Bulls record. They have 4 games left, so they can't afford to lose any of those. At the 2 spot, you're going to have San Antonio. They've won 65 games. They play each other. Golden State and San Antonio play each other next week. I'll be surprised if San Antonio plays anyone. He'll sit the whole bench. He might. If you go down and volunteer, you might get to play in that game for San Antonio. I'll bet Popovich rests everybody. Sitting at the 3 spot, the Oklahoma City Thunder, who for some reason, and I don't know what it is, but for some reason, the Oklahoma City Thunder keep finding ways to lose games down the stretch. I don't know what it is. I really don't. I don't know if it's an issue with Westbrook and Durant. I don't know what it is, but down the stretch, they seem to melt down. They did it again on Sunday against the Clippers. Sitting in that number 4 spot is the Los Angeles Clippers at 49-28. After that, it's wide open. It is wide open. You have Memphis. You have Portland. You have Dallas. You have Utah. You even have Houston still kind of right there, all kind of lurking. And they're all within like 3 or 4 games of each other. Now, who would you rather see in the playoffs of those top 4 teams? Probably Oklahoma City, right? I don't want to see Golden State. I don't want to see San Antonio. Maybe the Clippers? Maybe the Clippers? Next week is the final day of the regular season. Going to be kind of fun to watch how this all shapes up as we get down closer and closer to the end of the season. Oh, I did get one email this week. I did get one email that I wanted to make sure to read. I had two, but this was one that I actually wanted to read. Here's an email that I got to pull out of the mailbag here. Todd in Westminster writes in and says, "Hey Clint, thanks for doing the podcast. I listen to it every week. After watching the North Carolina players on Monday night, it got me thinking, why don't NBA players react like that when they lose in the NBA Finals?" Good question. Thanks for sending that in, Todd. I appreciate you know the email and you taking the time. A couple different reasons why you don't see, because if you watch the game on Monday night, Villanova hits the 3 to win it, and you just saw Carolina players like melt down, like they were devastated, completely lost. And I give Carolina players, I give that North Carolina team a ton of credit. They are an example of the way their coach coaches them. Roy Williams is always, you know, classy. They were classy in defeat. They came out. They did the interviews. They didn't get mad and walk out. you know, unlike some people from Carolina sometimes that might get mad at a post-game interview and get mad and walk out, they handled it. They took all the questions, but they were devastated. You could see them, you know, just sobbing on the court. A very, very painful situation for some young kids. Some of the reason at the NBA level, they're just more polished. They've done it more. They're older. They're more mature. They know how to deal with it. And plus, you know, when it comes to losing the NBA Finals, it just kind of seems like LeBron James is just sort of used to it. He knows how to cope, so he kind of just goes to his happy place. Major League Baseball got started this week. And sure, there really wasn't much made of it. As usual, Major League Baseball kind of just, you know, ties their own shoes together and then wonders why they fall down. There was no opening night special. In fact, I'll be honest. I didn't even know there were games that were being played that actually counted. Like, I was sitting there on, what was it, Sunday or Monday, whatever, and I was like the day before was Cactus League, and then the next day, oh, these count. These are live. There was no Hoopla. There was no concert. There was no media extravaganza. There was nothing. It was bizarre. I think to, like, the NFL, and the NFL, like, does it sometimes too over the top, but the NFL kind of does it the right way, don't they? I mean, they make a huge deal, and we're going to do it on Thursday night, and there's all this commercials, and here comes the season, and 2016 is coming, and here we put the best against the best, and we have a rematch maybe of a previous, you know, matchup from the year before, and they do all this stuff. Major League Baseball is like, oh yeah, by the way, our season started last night. What? Seriously? That's the best you can do? I realize that you guys hide your games. Like, playoff games are being played at, like, 10 in the morning, and like, most of your games are on these networks that I can't find. I understand all that. There was, like, no hype whatsoever for Major League Baseball opening day. I genuinely had no idea when it was even coming. So here's the deal. Because usually, like, right now I would be doing a Major League Baseball preview, but I'm going to be honest. If they don't care, then why should I? So, yeah, we'll just kind of leave that where it stands. Because, like I said, if you don't care enough to, like, you know, put some stuff out there, then I guess I really don't care enough to cover it either. So we'll kind of leave that where it's at. We'll get to it eventually. At some point, I'll probably, I don't know, talk some baseball, you know, when I feel like it. The NHL. You know, I like hockey. I'm an NHL fan. I love watching the NFL. Playoff hockey, I've told you before, playoff hockey is absolutely amazing. We haven't talked much hockey on the podcast, primarily, to be honest, because we're trying to get more listeners, not less. But it is interesting. Here's something that I want you to think about when it comes to the NHL. The season ends this week. I think the last game is on Saturday of the regular season. And there can still be a little bit of movement within the playoffs, but here's the thing I want you to think about. There will not be a single Canadian team in the playoffs this year. Ottawa, out. Montreal, out. Toronto, out. Vancouver, Calgary, Winnipeg, and Edmonton have all been eliminated from the NHL playoffs. Think about that for a minute. No Canadian teams? I mean, this is like their sport. No Canadian teams? I mean, this is like if there were no American teams making the NFL playoffs. Sorry, boys. Just the Canadian teams got into the NFL playoffs this year. I mean, like, I feel bad. I feel bad for the Canadians. Like, this is like their life. This is like their thing. You got, like, syrup and hockey. I mean, it's just, it's kind of crazy. I mean, I realize that up in Canada, they have like 48 different words for, you know, denim, but apparently they don't have any Canadian words for postseason. Kind of rough to watch. The NFL. I do want to talk a little bit about the NFL this week. I know the NFL is a year-round sport. They seem to always find their way into the news, but I do want to talk a little bit of the NFL. The Denver Broncos and the San Francisco 49ers. Right now, kind of in like a stalemate staring contest over quarterback Colin Kaepernick. Now, I've heard a few different reports. We heard last week the deal's going to get done. Then we heard the deal's dead, and we heard all these different things. Here's the situation. Colin Kaepernick is due about $5 million. I think it's around 4.9, something like that. The Broncos currently don't have any money. So, like, even if they wanted to pay for it, and they don't, but even if they wanted to pay for Colin Kaepernick to get him over here in a trade, they don't have any money. So until they renegotiate somebody, until they, you know, cut or renegotiate like Ryan Clady or something, they don't have any money anyways. It doesn't make any difference. They don't have the money to spend. So they can't pay it. San Francisco doesn't want to pay off his contract because they're like, he's going to leave. Why would we pay for it? So right now, everyone is just waiting. It seems like they've kind of agreed on the draft pick. Like Denver, I think, has said, we'll give you a third round pick or whatever it is. But no one wants to pay this bill. Like the tab's still coming due and no one wants to pay it. Everyone's passing the check back and forth to each other. So everyone just waits. Everyone's just going to sit and wait. Now, on Monday, the San Francisco 49ers actually started their offseason workouts, which Colin Kaepernick is attending. So even though he has said he wants to be traded, he kind of still has to attend those. Like you kind of have a contract. You still got to show up because you might still end up being there. Here's the thing that I want you to think about. And here's why John Elway is waiting. Because you might be sitting there going, why doesn't Elway just cut, you know, Clady and pay the money? Here's the thing to think about. Every single chance that Kaepernick's on the field is another chance that he falls and hurts himself. And then they end up paying all of his salary. And then they can't trade him. They got to keep him at that point. Because who's going to trade for him being broken even more than he's, you know, already broken? So be careful, San Francisco. Because I realize you're kind of trying to, you know, stare this down and you're kind of trying to be the gunslinger and be like, nope, I'm not going to flinch. We're not going to flinch. Yeah, well, it's all fun and games until he, you know, slips and blows out his knee. And then you're not getting nothing for him. So I expect this to go on a while. I expect both teams to sit there staring at each other probably until the draft. And then we'll see if a move gets made. You know Denver still wants to move Clady. They're kind of in the same situation. They've got to find a team that would be willing to give them a little bit for him because they know they can't really afford to keep him. And he doesn't seem like he's going to renegotiate too much. Maybe he would renegotiate if he was going to be traded. I don't know. Going to be interesting to kind of keep an eye on this because the Broncos and the Niners right now, they're just kind of staring each other down and saying, yeah, we're not going to give in. Yeah, well, we're not giving in either. We'll see. Somebody's going to have to give in eventually. Somebody's going to have to do something because Kaepernick has said he wants out. And John Elway has spoken to Kaepernick now twice, they say. He has had conversations with him. Going to be interesting to see how this all plays out over the next stretch. And you know, we're a little less than a month from the NFL draft. So we'll kind of keep an eye on that. Did you see that former Carolina Panther, former Dallas Cowboy, and you know, woman beater Greg Hardy allowed an ESPN interview with Adam Schefter? He you know, said, hey, why don't you come over to, I don't know, wherever it was, Mississippi or Tennessee or something, and said, I'll conduct an interview for you if you'd like to come over. In the interview, Hardy says he has never hit a woman, and he would never do that. Like, that's not the way he was raised. He was raised in the Bible Belt, and he would never do that. Yeah, okay. A couple things about this. First off, he couldn't even make sense when he was trying to say this. Like, nothing he said was even making sense. But understand what Greg Hardy is doing. He currently doesn't have a job. And no teams are interested in him because of the public outcry it will cause if they sign him. Now, Greg Hardy's sports agent is Drew Rosenhaus. We all remember Drew Rosenhaus. Remember him with the Terrell Owens thing. Remember him with a couple of a little bit, let's say, shaky clients that he's had. So Drew Rosenhaus goes up and he sets up this little play that Hardy and Schefter acted out in. And so what he does is he makes it be in like a nice house and he puts some flowers behind him and Hardy's going to show what a great guy he is. And he's kind of funny and he's really charming and he might talk about God and how his life has changed and he might be wearing a flowered dress and an Easter bonnet. I don't know, but understand this. All this is an I need a job interview. That's all this is. Remember when Ray Rice had cold cocked his wife or whatever in the elevator and had like knocked her out? And then he did a couple of these interviews and it was basically to see if he could drum up some sympathy and be like, oh, look, I made a slight mistake, but come on, guys, I need a job. And so we'll just overlook the fact that you dropped your wife with a left hook. This is the same thing. This guy needs a job. Now, they are saying there is one team out there who is really interested in signing Greg Hardy. Okay, well, why don't you sign with him? There are no teams out there interested in signing Greg Hardy. No one's willing to put up with this. And again, Here's the problem. If he was better at his job, he would be getting more looks. But we saw again with Dallas last year, he's okay. Wasn't anything great. We saw with Ray Rice, he's kind of running out of gas. If he could play, they would still sign him. He's not quite as good as what everyone thought he was, and so he's not getting the looks. But when you see this interview on there, understand all this is, guys, I really need a job. No one's going to sign me, and I'm out of work. That's all this is. Nothing to do with anything else. And when you hear him talk, when you hear the conversation, he doesn't even make any sense. I don't even know what the man is saying. So you never hit a woman. Nope, I never hit a woman. You've never touched a woman. Nope, I wasn't raised that way. I was raised in the Bible Belt. You don't do that in the Bible Belt. First off, I know some people in the Bible Belt. Down in the Bible Belt, not the most uncommon thing for somebody to backhand a woman. Let's be real clear. But having said that, then he says, well, now I wouldn't say I'm innocent and everything. Okay, well then what are you not innocent of? Would you say that you've ever, I don't know, taken your ex-wife or girlfriend and thrown her onto a bed of guns? Would you not be innocent of that? And then Schefter, and Schefter's a smart guy. Schefter spent a lot of time in Denver. I like Schefter. Schefter's just lobbing up softballs. Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad you answered that, Greg Hardy. That was a really good answer. Schefter, why don't you at least ask him, well, what about throwing her on a bed full of guns? And how come she didn't show up at the trial? What happened there? Where was she on the whole trial thing? Really? All you did is lob up softballs? Disappointing. Disappointing. Once again, the major sports media outlets don't always tend to get it right. In fact, more times than not, they get it wrong. As we do every single week, we have got to get over to our Daily Dose Top 5 with the phenomenal game that we saw on Monday night. Great championship game. One of the best championship games that I personally have ever witnessed. I started thinking about some of the greatest shots in championship history. You know, you think back to some of the great shots in tournament history. And obviously, you know, you have like a shot like the Tate George shot from UConn. Maybe you're too young to know what that is, but look it up. You might think about the Christian Laettner shot against Kentucky. That was actually the Final Four, not the championship game. But I started thinking about some of the great shots in championship history, because there have been some amazing shots that have taken place in championship history. Now, again, I have to preface this. I can't go back to the 40s. I can't go back when they were playing with like a lead ball and Abraham Lincoln was the coach for one of the teams. These are the games that I've seen. So forgive me if I don't have some great shot from back when like Oregon Tech was in the... I'm not old enough to do that. But I will give you the top five championship shots of all time. At least that I've seen. In 2008, number five on our list. 2008, Memphis versus Kansas. This game was a kind of a crazy game. It was a game of runs, and I know basketball is always a game of runs, but I want you to think about this. The Memphis Tigers started the game hot. They were up 9-3. In fact, that was the biggest deficit in 2008 that Kansas had seen in the tournament to that point. They were down by 6. The Jayhawks storm right back. They go up by 7. They're up 22-15. I mean, just back and forth. Memphis ties the game at 28 at halftime. Okay, both made our runs, both took some chances. But in the second half, you started to see Memphis, they had a pretty good freshman. His name was Derrick Rose, and Derrick Rose took over in the second half. He scored 13 of his 16 points. Tigers are up 9 with just over 2 minutes left to play. One problem, there was kind of that doubt, there was kind of that question, if the game's on the line, can Memphis hit their free throws? They had struggled at times during the season to hit their free throws. And let's be real honest, we've seen Calipari teams struggle at the line just a little bit. And this was a John Calipari team. Yes, they were 9 of 12 up to this point. They had hit 9 of 12 free throws to this point. But now, like I said earlier, the game changed when things get tight. It's all fun and games in the first half, and we're just out there shooting threes and shooting free throws that really don't have much on them. They don't have, you know, the pressure on them. But now, we're under 2 minutes left, and now these free throws really, really count. They went 3 of 7 down the stretch, clanked 4 free throws, big free throws. Make any of them, this game's over. Make any of those free throws. Just make one of them, this game's over. 10 seconds left. Hey, Kansas is down 3. Kansas has got to get a shot off. They get Derrick Rose misses the first of a 2-point free throw, makes the second to make it a 3-point game, and guard Sherrod Collins for Kansas drives down to the other end of the floor. He kind of starts falling down. They need a three. There's less than 10 seconds. Clock is ticking, and they need a three. He finds Mario Chalmers kind of falling down, and Chalmers takes a little bit of an off-balance three-pointer that's going to tie it and give them a chance to go into overtime. Well, why don't you go ahead and listen to the call from CBS Sports.
Kansas has made only 2 threes on the night. They must make one here to extend the game. Collins driving, almost lost the handle. Chalmers for the tie. Got it for 2 seconds. Unbelievable. Dozier at midcourt for the championship. No, we're going to overtime in San Antonio.
Of course, Kansas would go on to beat Memphis in overtime. A phenomenal game and a huge, huge shot by Mario Chalmers to finish the game in regulation. Moving on to number 4. 1987, you might remember Indiana versus Syracuse in 1987. You know, Indiana guard Keith Smart actually wasn't like a guy that you looked at and said he really deals with pressure that well. You know, like a week before, Indiana had senior day and his family had come. Keith Smart had hyperventilated and almost passed out. Now, they're in the championship game in New Orleans. Where is Keith Smart from? Yeah, he's from down in the New Orleans area. He was playing in front of his family. And so he was really, really nervous about going out and playing. He had just had this situation on senior night. So to relax, the night before the game, I'll go out, I'll eat some, you know, some home kind of food. I'll eat some Cajun food, feel a little bit better, and go into the game tomorrow. Yeah, except he was up sick all night from the Cajun food. He started the game, didn't play very well at all. And actually, Bob Knight had sat him out. In the second half, Syracuse had an 8-point game. You might remember this team, Sherman Douglas, Derek Coleman, pretty scrappy team that Syracuse had. In the second half, Keith Smart goes back in. He had said, I thought when Bob Knight had pulled me, I thought I was done for the night. Knight puts him back in, and Smart, I don't know why, you know, maybe he was tired, maybe his whatever it was, his focus changed. He comes in, and he gets hot, starts knocking down some shots, actually pulls Indiana within a point. With just, you know, like 20 seconds left, freshman Derek Coleman, who had played an amazing game. Think about this. Derek Coleman's a freshman. Dude had 20 points and 19 rebounds. He's got a 1-1 that he's shooting, can put Syracuse up. They're up by one. He can extend that lead out to 3. Misses the front end of the 1-1, and Indiana gets the ball and goes the other way. When they go the other way, something to think about, and you'll hear on the broadcast that the announcer says that Syracuse is playing a man-to-man. They're not. Syracuse was playing a box and one. They had put a one on Steve Alford because up to this point, Steve Alford had already hit 7 three-pointers. They were very, very worried that he was going to hit another one to win it. The ball kind of moves around. They're shadowing Alford with the box and one. It goes over to Keith Smart in the corner, and, well, you'll have to listen to it for yourself.
He's short. Indiana can win it.
And they decide to put Douglas on Alford. And they go man-to-man.
Smart takes the shot. Oh, and the Hoosiers with 3 seconds. Indiana wins the championship. Keith Smart is the hero.
That call again coming to us from CBS Sports. You know, Keith Smart, you look at the shot, and you can see these shots on YouTube or whatever. I don't know if it's the shot that Bob Knight would have wanted. He's kind of leaning. He kind of drives. He drives into the gap, which you should do because, like I said, it was a boxing one. You had the 2-2. He drives into that gap, and he's kind of leaning. But it's not a great-looking shot. But, hey, he managed to knock it down. A huge shot. Syracuse really didn't get a chance to even get a shot off after that. We move on to our number 3 greatest shots of championship games. I mean, 1982, North Carolina versus Georgetown, one of the greatest games in championship history. Here's something to think about. Dean Smith and John Thompson were actually very, very close friends. John Thompson considered Dean Smith one of his mentors. Prior to the game, they had kind of gotten together, you know, do the half-court thing and had kind of talked to each other. And they kind of had discussed, you know, I, I, obviously we're excited to be here and that kind of thing. I don't want to see you lose. And the others, yeah, and I don't want to see you lose. And early in the game, Patrick Ewing gets fouled. And as he gets fouled, he's walking to the free throw line. Now, if you don't know this, Patrick Ewing had a habit of going to the free throw line and taking like 10, 12 seconds to get his shot off. Now, at 10 seconds, that's a violation, and you got to give the ball up. Dean Smith goes over to the officials, and here's what he says. He says, now, hey, understand this. He tells the refs, Patrick goes for over 10 seconds at the line, but I don't want you to call it. We all know he does it. I'm okay with it. John and I, we're cool. I just want to let you know. So don't call it even though he does it. Now, we all know what Dean Smith is doing. He is working those refs. He's putting that bug in their ear. And when John Thompson heard that, he said, oh, okay. He still is trying to win this game. He's acting like he wasn't going to try to win this game. He knew it was on at that point. Back and forth game. Excellent game back and forth. Late in the game, less than a minute to go, Georgetown leads 62-61. Dean Smith took a timeout, and he didn't usually do that. Dean Smith was known for kind of letting his guys play it out and just kind of see how it would go. Dean Smith took a timeout. They looked a little bit confused, and during the timeout, he said, hey, they may come out in a 1-3-1. And if they do, he told this young guard that usually went by the name of Mike Jordan, that if they come out in that 1-3-1, you're going to be open on the backside wing. Knock it down if you get it. It went exactly like Dean Smith thought it would.
A one-point lead for Georgetown.
No, they stay in the 1-3-1 with Ewing in the middle. They've got to look to get it in there. You can't with a shot blocker like Ewing take so much time.
Gordy to Black. The time, 18. Shot, Jordan! Michael Jordan,
14 seconds.
Brown.
Look for Sleepy Floyd.
Oh, he threw it to the wrong man. He threw it to Worthy.
It's over. It's over.
Again, that call coming to us from CBS Sports. You know, the play went down just like Dean Smith had said it would. He said he thought they would come out in 1-3-1. If it swung over to Michael Jordan, he was to knock it down. Here's something you might not know. You might not be aware of this. For one, he was kind of known as Mike Jordan. He was never really known as Michael. He says until he knocked down that shot with 17 seconds left to give Carolina and Dean Smith their first national championship, at least for Dean Smith. Did you know that Michael Jordan, coming out of high school and going into college at North Carolina, went by a different nickname? He wasn't Michael Jordan. Do you know what he went by? He went by Magic Mike. Kind of disturbing, I know, with the movies that we have now. But in fact, I think he might have even had the license plate on his car as a teenager. Said Magic Mike. So, you know, he had that going for before he was Michael. He was just Magic Mike. Knocked down a huge shot in the championship game against Georgetown. Number two on our list has got to be 1983 North Carolina State versus Houston. You know, North Carolina State has always been kind of the little brother to North Carolina. Never quite as good, never quite as big, just kind of the little brother to North Carolina. And they were going to face Phi Slamma Jamma. You know, North Carolina State, they live in that shadow of Carolina. Jim Valvano told a story that when he started at North Carolina State, he received an anonymous letter. And the letter said, beat North Carolina or we'll kill your dog. And Valvano just kind of laughed when he got the letter because he didn't even own a dog. So it really wasn't, you know, a big concern. A few weeks later, this package arrives. It's got a beautiful puppy. It's got like a golden lab in it, just a gorgeous little puppy. And the kids come in and they see it, and the wife comes in and she sees it. And there's a note on the puppy that says, Jim Valvano, don't get too attached. You know, North Carolina State got hot in 1983, and they found a way to keep surviving and surviving and surviving every round of the tournament. They ended up meeting Houston in the championship game. Houston was loaded. You had Akeem Olajuwon. You had Clyde Drexler. Here are two guys on the same collegiate basketball team who would end up being top 50 players of all time in the NBA. All week, they would interview Jim Valvano, and Valvano said, hey, we're just going to stall. We're just going to delay. We don't have the people. We're going to come out and go four corners because we can't possibly compete with these guys. Now, privately, He was telling North Carolina State, we're not doing that. We're going to come out, we're going to play, and we're going to beat these guys. I'm not afraid of them. I'm not scared of them. But he was saying all those things, we're going to stall. There was no way he was going to stall. That just wasn't who Jimmy V was. So the game starts. They come out, and they're getting right after it. Like, they're shooting. They're putting up shots. They're playing just like they normally do. It was kind of a surprise to Houston. Houston was taken a little bit off guard. The only problem was Carolina State really wasn't shooting the ball that well. They shot 39% for the game, but it did kind of put Houston on their heels, and as a result, Houston didn't shoot that well either. They kind of scrapped and clawed and stayed in it late in the game. North Carolina State is down by one with 30 seconds left. I'll be honest. I watched the possession. Nothing goes right. They're not moving the ball very well. They're spaced very well, but they're almost too far, and Houston is now getting aggressive and jumping the passing lanes like two or three times. They nearly turn it over. They end up taking a horrible shot, and somehow they still ended up winning the game. Check out this call from CBS Sports.
Yes, he's three guards in there now as Gannon's in there with Wittenberg and Lowe.
Down to 25 seconds, dangerous pass.
This is a really interesting strategy by Houston. They're aggressive now, not staying back.
Well, remember they have Akeem in there to block anything that goes inside. Down to 14 seconds.
Oh, almost stolen by Drexler. Boy, is he good at
that. They've got a drive to the basket. It's down to 7 seconds.
You can see the time. Wittenberg. Oh, that's a long ways. Oh!
I know that call's a little bit tougher, you know, to follow. If you haven't seen the game, I would encourage you to go check it out. North Carolina State versus Houston in 1983, our number two biggest shot in championship games ever. The shot, to this day, there's still some dispute. Derek Wittenberg fires it up from about, I don't know, 8 feet off the three-point line. I think it's going to go short. I don't think it has a chance to touch anything. And Carolina State, big man, Lorenzo Charles, goes up, grabs it, drops it through the hoop as the buzzer sounds. If we had it again, would that count? Like, with all the instant replay stuff and everything that they have, would that still count? I don't know. But an amazing, amazing finish to a crazy, crazy game. The thing about that game, and that game was so entertaining, that game was such a huge upset. I don't know if it was that well played of a game. Like the game the other night was such a well-played game, good shooting, good defense, good all-around play. I don't know if Carolina State was quite as good, quite as well-played as that game was. They seemed like they struggled a little bit at times. Sometimes it was a little bit sloppy, but Carolina State, you got to give that team just so much credit because they found a way to get a victory when it mattered. Number one on our list, our Daily Dose top five championship shots of all time. Hey, what else could it be? Honestly, what else could I put on here? Because not only on Monday night did we get one great shot, we got two. You know, Villanova was up 10 with less than 5 minutes. Carolina comes back, and you know, Villanova has a couple empty possessions. Carolina suddenly kind of finds some ways to generate some offense. When Marcus Page hits this shot at the end, there's only 4.7 seconds left. Let's be honest. We all kind of thought we might be headed to overtime. It kind of looked that way when this shot went down. Here's another call from CBS Sports.
We had the hot hand from three in the first half. They're going to have to do something from the outside now. It's Page off balance. Puts it out.
Marcus Page with the twisting double clutch three-pointer, completely off balance. I don't know how he got it to go in. And when I watch it again, I'll be honest, it probably shouldn't have gone in. It kind of hits the back of the rim, and it kind of bounces around and drops through. I don't know how he got it to go in, but it looked like we were headed for overtime. It looked like we were going to get five more minutes of championship basketball. Unfortunately, they inbound the ball to point guard Ryan Archie Diacono. And, you know, Archie Diacono brings the ball up, and everyone, they're kind of giving him some token pressure. They're kind of keeping an eye on him. But everyone's kind of forgetting about inbounder Chris Jenkins, who is just kind of trailing the play and trailing the play. And Archie Diacono comes and runs at Jenkins, runs that little dribble handoff, and gives Jenkins a wide open look at a three-point shot. He's a deadly shooter. He's a 50% shooter from three-point range. the best championship shot of all time. Another call that comes to us from CBS Sports.
With Archie Diacono, 3 seconds at midcourt.
Jenkins
gives it to Jenkins for the championship. The national champions with Jenkins hitting the winner at the buzzer.
Now, there are a couple of things from that shot that stand out to me. A few things that stand out to me from that shot. The first thing that stands out to me about that shot is if you watch Villanova head coach Jay Wright, right as they run the dribble handoff and he lets it go, they have a camera on Jay Wright and you see him mouth and just go bang. And I don't think it was anything underwhelming. I don't think it was anything. I think he just looked at it and said, this team is going to do this again. This team has found ways to win all year. Bang, this game's over. And he knew it right when he let it go. The other thing, like you look at the shot and you say, what a gutty play and what a, you know, kind of a gritty play. And they find a way to get it done. And Jenkins, how clutch was he? Here's the guy I want to nominate for the bravest guy of the night. How about the guy that blows up the streamers and the fireworks as that shot goes down? We weren't positive if the shot had gotten off in time. Hey, the guy who lets the streamers go and lets the, you know, the indoor fireworks go, he's the brassest guy of them all. He had no question that shot was going down. He had no question that that shot counted. Our greatest championship shot of all time gotta come from this season, 2016, Villanova over North Carolina. Hey, next week on the show, you know, we might have to get to a couple college basketball awards. The season is over. As you know, how we always do here on the Daily Dose, we might have to hand out a couple of college basketball awards. Plus, we will have an NBA playoff preview. We should know who is going to be playing who in the NBA playoffs. You know, we might have to talk some baseball. I don't know. Is baseball, I guess, started? I guess they started. I'm not really sure, but at some point, we'll get around to baseball when, you know, they let us know that they're actually playing games that count. And as we always do, you got to stick around for our Daily Dose Top 5. You never know which way that is going to go. Hey, if you get a chance, head over to iTunes, head over to Stitcher, head over to Podcast Republic, wherever it is that you download the podcast. Give us a quick 5-star rating and a review. We would appreciate that so much. Have to say thank you to JSP. Could not do any of this without you. Thank you, all of you, for listening. I really do appreciate it. Thank you for the emails. Thank you for the tweets, the stuff on Facebook. It is very, very much appreciated. I will see you all next week.